Horror fans, NABNew.com is your new destination for keeping up with the latest horror collectibles. At launch, NAB is aggregating 27 of the top online stores into a place so you can find a new release of DVDs, toys, figures, comics, vinyl soundtracks, board games, and more. Simply follow your favorite horror properties and you'll get a custom feed with all of the day's new releases that matter to you. And since we have everything in one place, you can easily compare prices across vendors, check stock availability, and nab it before it's gone. NAB is more than just horror. You can follow everything from American Psycho to My Hero Academia. So we put together a special collection for Shockwaves fans. Visit nabnew.com/horror to check it out. That's nabnew, nabnew.com/horror.
This week's episode is also sponsored by RLJE Films. Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space starring Nicolas Cage is now available on 4K, UHD, Blu-ray, DVD, and digital. Own it now on Amazon.com and experience the color with Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space.
It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria vaults. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table-worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and the weird cinema to customize. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you are looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online today at DiabolikTVD.com.
Welcome to episode 179 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm sitting across from Elric Kane instead of next to.
I am so happy to be sitting down this week. Last week we stood. You don't know
don't
what pain we went through.
Don't be a baby.
It was fun.
We were standing in Slashback Video.
I stood the week before that as well, by the way.
Really?
Because
Rebecca
we were
McKendry,
at the burger joint.
Our other co-host.
I'm all the way down at the other end of the table, guys.
How did you feel standing the last 2 weeks in a row?
I don't mind it, actually. I think Elric's just whining.
I liked it, but at the 40-minute mark, I was like, you know what? Let's wrap this
I'm
show
the
up.
One who you offered to sit on the floor, and you were all like, guys, I can't sit on the
we
floor.
We have to stand.
And we have to stand. I'm not sitting on the floor.
I'm the diva of the group. This is true.
You are the diva.
You are the diva.
I'm not the curmudgeon. That's Rob.
That is me, for sure.
I don't know what would we give Becca. If I'm the diva, what's Becca?
If you dare say the girl, I'm going to just walk out. No, I'm leaving both of you.
The girl is definitely Turk. We know that.
She's the optimistic one, I guess. I don't know.
No, there's like, no. Well, she's the Tracy Flick. I don't know what that is.
Thank you.
I just know what she is in the
Tracy. Is that an election? True, guys.
It is an erection reference. Which is perfect for our guest.
And on that,
our guest puts out movies that have erections.
They do have some erections.
Right? Sort of. Sometimes. We're going to have Severin films back on the show.
Yes.
David Gregory, it's been quite a long time.
Super fun announcements, hopefully.
Kathy's Curse 2, perhaps?
No,
we don't
there's
know.
There's no sequel to Kathy's
but
Curse.
There could
don't
be.
Get Brian Collins' hopes up.
I know. I don't want to do that.
But that should be a lot of fun. We actually just recorded their Severin Cellar segment, yes, which will probably be up by the time this episode goes up.
Yeah, it's apparently Nothing like the Criterion version of that at all. So just imagine something totally different, and that's what it is.
It was fun.
It is a lot of fun, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And I mean, that's the fun thing is that I think next week we're back in the regular offices,
this
but we've been
three
traveling.
Weeks.
Three
yeah,
weeks
that
in
feels
a row.
Boring, guys. Let's keep traveling.
I love keeping Ernie, our sound engineer, on his toes, man.
Yeah, Ernie's like,
him.
Where are we this week?
Where?
He loves the challenge.
We're gonna get, places.
We're now at the Target in Pacoima. And yeah, we're just going to start coming up with weird places.
If we bring alcohol, he is open to the challenge.
If we can, we are in deep trouble. This is all in. So we're actually not at the Severn office. The Severn's offices are downstairs. We are in the office of Jim Koons, former guest, who does so much for basically the documentary Blu-ray community. Yeah. He was on our show quite a while ago. He's long overdue for a trip back.
We're sitting in front of the wall of everything that he's worked on. It is, and I am floored.
Yeah, we should take a photo. I was telling Ernie before, he has literally shot something for every disc that's to our right, to Elric's left. And by the way, fun tidbit that I should mention, this very space that we're in, believe it or not, Mick Garris, our friend who does Postmortem, came here to shoot an interview for something, probably Sleepwalkers or whatever. And he told Jimmy, he's like, dude, this is where my band rehearsed in the 70s. This room that we're in right now, this space used to be where Mick Garris and his band used to rehearse.
Oh, man.
So I love that. That's the beauty of Hollywood.
That's sometimes LA.
The history. It's very LA.
Yeah. The places that survive are really always filled with great ghosts. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
No, but also he, in the room next to us, even more impressive than what he worked on, there's a room next to us with, and you would have heard him mention when he was on the show, he's working on a documentary of horror novelizations.
Yep.
And,
with last week's guest, Stephen Scarlett.
Yes, with Stephen Scarlett. And next door are all the books they've collected for that, and it is unbelievable.
I just skimmed the novelization of Inseminoid, guys. That is in there.
And there's
it
two
exists.
Versions of Herschel Gordon Lewis' Blood Feast.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and so I have one of the Thousand Maniacs ones, and there's different versions. And so we were in there comparing our versions because I have the 90s one with pictures in it.
Yeah, I can't wait for this film because I love really specific documentaries like that when niche things in horror. I think I'm over the general, like, hey, we're going to do 50 horror films. I think we've seen enough of that stuff now, but when people go niche, there's still so much to explore and so many voices like these writers who I'm like, who are these people who are making, writing the book without having seen the film?
Well, I mean, look, that's the fun thing that ties into our last episode, Best Movies Never Made. Yeah, it's like, that's kind of Steve Scarlatta's expertise is studying all these versions of things. And most of the time, novelizations are running off of a first draft.
Yeah.
So you usually get these weird deleted scenes or plot lines that just go in really weird directions. And so I'm always fascinated by it. Like the Halloween novelization, which I do have in the movie, you know, he's a little kid and then he escapes. The novelization has like this entire chapter of him in the mental institution, kind of like being the cause of accidents that kill other kids. It's like this whole backstory that you're like, wait, what is this?
Let's just remember Jaws, Voodoo Curse.
Yeah.
That's in Jaws the Revenge.
Jaws the Revenge.
Oh my God.
That is cool.
It's all a voodoo curse.
Which actually is kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'd watch it. And if you're listening to this and you have the Pitt adaptation called Teddy, it's very difficult to get. Please donate it to them so I can read it. He's been looking for one. Brian Collins stole it out of his hand at a book fair.
And
Jim was reaching for it. And he said he saw Brian's hand come out of nowhere, grab it. And Brian's not going to read. Hey, he hasn't got
That's
time
terrible.
To read.
Come on.
Brian has no time to read. He's watching too many movies. I just want to read it because I hear it's really different than the movie. So I do want to read that one day.
We have a couple of really good antique book fairs around
one's
LA.
Coming up.
One, it was just 2 weekends ago, the one in Pasadena, the antique book fair
No wonder
Pasadena.
I don't get my copy of Teddy. I'm always 2 weeks late to the fair.
And I was at the one in Glendale last year. And that one, Brian, I remember seeing Andrew Cash walking around there as well. That one was insane because when most people are looking for like what they're going to sell at these antique book fairs, it's like, I have this, you know, 18th century pressing of Alice in Wonderland. Right. And it's, you know, all of these like really nice leather bound tomes, classic canons of literature. And in the meantime, we're all there like elbowing for like who gets the novelization for, various stuff. So most of which were pennies. So it was a fun place.
That's crazy.
Well, fuck books. Let's talk about movies.
Movies.
Or whatever. What has anyone seen? Well, first, actually, Rob, you didn't see as much this week, but you made it to where we were last and we didn't get to make it yet.
Yeah.
To Slashback.
The new version of Slashback. Yeah. I mean, well, when we recorded the show, they were still a couple of days away from actually completing it. I mean, it looked pretty much what it was going to be. And, I went opening night. Opening night is always, I think it's a bittersweet mixed bag because it's great to celebrate with all these people. And it was pretty incredible. I mean, lots of our friends are there. Tiffany Shepis and, Felissa Rose, who do, the Casualty Friday podcast. I bumped into Michael Dougherty, director of Trick or Treat and the new Godzilla. And he actually said to me, he's like, I've never been to one of these yet. And I'm actually having an emotional reaction right now. Like he walked in and saw the shelves and he's like I'm actually having trouble for a second.
So
I need a second to, you know, soak this all in. So it's always great to just see familiar faces. One of the artists that submitted a piece of art was, I guess, is the wife of the drummer of Blink 182. So he was there, but I didn't see him. I just saw the post of him and everything. Huh. So opening night was great. And I've seen a little bit of the narrative version of it, and I think it's really cool. Again, it's, you know, something that you probably picked up on just listening from the show is that Ryan and his wife Sierra are huge fans of escape rooms. Mm. They love that. And so I feel like he's slowly turning like Slashback started out as just like an exhibit that you like.
It was,
you know,
like an art experience.
Yeah, like an art experience. Basically. And now it's an art experience that has a little touch of escape room. I think they're going to keep pushing it that way, which I think is super cool.
Yeah.
So, no, it was excellent. It was great. And it's going to be up until June. Yeah. So, and I mean, they went all out with the neon. Like, there's neon lights everywhere. I walked in the other day after the show and Power of Love, Huey Lewis is playing. I was like, yes, I am in the 80s. This is beautiful.
And a good reason to go to this kind of thing when there's no one there is to really take
the time.
Like, I'd like to take my phone out, my Letterboxd account, and go through and where are the movies I've never heard of?
Yeah.
Make a couple notes, because sometimes these are the ones that you, if it's not streaming and if it's not on DVD, you might have forgotten they exist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they're still there on VHS somewhere. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, it was a lot of fun. If you're anywhere in Burbank, you should definitely go check it out. I think it's like, I don't know how much it is. It's like $10 or something like that, $10, $12, but totally worth it. I'd go just on a weekday afternoon if you're able, or like Sunday, so you could really take your time, play a couple rounds of Splatterhouse because they have the arcade game there.
Oh yeah.
We gotta ask Ryan if they could do a thing like I'm with Shockwaves and get in for like 10% less. I feel like that's gotta be a thing.
Yeah, let's do a Shockwaves discount, maybe.
Like the Shockwaves password.
Speaking of which, he's not here, but I assume it's because he's sleeping off building that.
Building, yes. Exactly.
I'm gonna assume he's sleeping.
Actually, he texted me just as we were talking about him. So somebody's ears are ringing.
Okay, good.
But yeah, what have you guys been watching this last week?
I watched an entire... So I've only seen two TV shows this whole year. Like, in the entire year, I haven't even watched any TV. One of them was Refn's thing towards the end. I kind of wanted to talk about him because someone really liked it.
Yeah.
Though I can see it going either way for people. But I started Hunters.
Oh, me I've been too. Watching that as well.
So I watched the first episode on Friday.
Yep.
And it was the first episode. I do want to say I think it's the best episode so far.
Which is feature length, by the way. The first episode, actually an hour and a half.
And,
like a
and so because it just has scope and surprises, but I actually finished the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I don't know how I did that. Episodes? Yeah, I was just watching like two or three a night over the weekend, and they just suddenly all was over. And I don't want to go because you guys are still going there. I'm not going to go there. But it goes in a very bonkers direction.
I'm on episode three.
Me too. I just finished three.
Yeah.
And the tone is so all over the place.
The tone is weird. It's like not because at first in the pilot, I think that's why the pilot's best. For my taste, the pilot's best because it's a little more serious with some of the tone. But then it starts going to like kind of exploitation and grindhouse and comic book and weird infomercial.
The chess scene was where I was like, this does not feel historically accurate.
Yeah. It feels it feels like a comic book adaptation.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, okay, so if we get the one serious thing I'd say about, because I have watched it all now and most of it's really fun and good. And I think the stuff about the prisons is really good, well done, tasteful. I had an issue with the chess scene
for
a very simple reason, which is, and this is not a too big a spoiler because it's only a couple episodes in, but there's this brutal chess game that they have all the Jews on the chess playing each other. And when they take over somebody's square, they kill the person.
Yeah.
I fundamentally don't believe that the Jewish people would have actually done that. And that I think they would let themselves be killed before they'd killed another in a camp situation. That was the only thing, but I think it gets away with it because it is a fantasy version of these things. But that was the only time my back was like, wait a minute. I feel pretty strongly about this moment because I do feel like as a people, it's very peaceful. And the way they survived the war was not that way. A lot of people sacrificed themselves for others not. So that's the one moment that felt like, yeah, it's a cool idea.
I read that one. You know? There was an article the next morning. It was either on NPR or CNN or one of the sites I usually get like news feed from. And they were talking that was a really controversial scene across the board because it is so historically inaccurate.
Right.
It is almost somehow. How exploiting. Like, it does feel exploitation.
Well, it is exploitation. And Inglourious Basterds is exploitation too. But somehow, it still works though. The show as you go. There are a couple moments like that, but there's also moments that are very, very emotional in some of the flashbacks. And it is cathartic.
Yeah.
Like, you know, my grandmother's a New York Jew whose parents came over from Poland. And like, I watch this thing and there's a part of me that's like kind of swelling with pride. Like, yeah, kick ass. Like, go get it. So, but it goes somewhere very bonkers. There's an ending, a main ending that I was almost a little angry about, and that's why I don't want to say too much. But then there's an ending after the ending where I was like, okay, maybe I'm back on for two. Yeah. But either way, I watched the whole thing because it was fun, and I had a good time.
By the way, we should mention Jordan Peele is the producer of the show, and Al Pacino's great in it. Yeah, it's very weird to me because I think the stuff that does deal with the concentration camps and is so emotional and serious that I'm really taken aback by the comedic.
Dylan Baker is just crazy.
Dylan Baker is insane. And then there's a musical number in the third episode that really threw me off.
Completely. Like, I still have not pinned down the tone, and I'm three episodes in. And
you
I'm
won't.
Still.
I think even by the end, it's still playing with all these different tones. And I, you know, I usually that doesn't work for me, but in this, I was like, you know what? Have fun.
But I'm wondering, I mean, now it's jarring for us, but I'm wondering if that's the thing that's going to set this apart when all is said and done, maybe.
I think people have a very strong feelings by the time they get to the end. So this is me being spoiler free, but it is not safe. It does something where you're like, whoa, that's a big choice. Not a little. So, you know, you'll start seeing, that's why you should avoid think pieces because people will start writing about this
and
early.
Spoil it,
and spoil it because it's all out there. But,
well, in a couple of weeks, my old friend Amy Duddleton, who edits the show, is going to be on. So we'll get
and
to talk
definitely
to her
Dexter
about
Dexter vibes. And I know she's the editor.
She was on Dexter, American Gods.
So yeah, we'll talk about this again. Hopefully you guys will be further along by then. But I was surprised. That's like I said, I've only seen two shows, so I'm surprised I watched so much.
What was the second show?
It was Nicholas Refn's show.
Which you said was spotty.
Well, no, I ended up loving it, but it's like super. It makes like the one after Drive, Only God Forgives, which is slower than anything. It makes that feel fast.
Wow.
But it somehow after like two or three episodes, you get so into it, and it's like kind of amazing. It's like this crazy 18-hour movie he made. By the end, I kind of loved it by the end. But it's not, you know, you'd have to gauge. It's really between Drive, Only God Forgives, and Neon Demon. It's all of them mixed into one. You get bits of all three of those films throughout a series. And like there's episode
anthology?
It's this one crime story, but episode one builds up all the characters, like the guy from Whiplash, right? Your lead character. Episode two, he's not even in the episode. So it's doesn't care about narrative at all, but it's got some really cool stuff. I think if you're into that, you've probably already seen it. But it took me seeing somebody really go to the bat for it that I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. Otherwise, I was staying away. So
I want to watch William Friedkin watching Rough Show.
Oh, that's right. Because he had
have you ever seen that YouTube clip? He's interviewing William Friedkin and he refers to, is it Only God Forgives?
Yeah.
He's like, when I made my masterpiece, I'm like, God forgives. Friedkin's like, hey, hold on a second. And basically, he just chews him out. He's like, we're not even sure Drive's going to be any good in about 5 years. He's like, don't call your movie a bastard.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
It's Friedkin.
It's Friedkin.
And Friedkin's totally right. I mean, I think Drive will be a masterpiece years, but I don't think Only God Forgives. So, whatever. But, you know, reference fun to watch. So that's the show I watch. What about you, Big?
So I watched a bunch of just kind of oddball movies that came up randomly. I'll start with Frightmare from 1983. And this one...
Do you know who made that? That is the guy who from last week's show when I talked about The Black Room. This is his other film.
Are you serious?
Yes. I don't like this one nearly as much as Black Room, but because it's comic and weird.
Yeah, Black Room I love. This one was still pretty fun. I do have to say there was something about this that I loved, but it was still kind of spoofy and campy and self-aware, and it kind of lost me in that. So this one came about just that last night it was like 10 o'clock and I was on a treadmill and I was like, what's on Prime? And hey guys, this is on Prime.
Wow. Great cover too. There's a great cover.
Oh, the cover is beautiful. It has nothing to do with the movie whatsoever, but it is just with the, everyone will remember the box cover of the skull with the curved knife going through the eyes.
Yeah.
So a real sacred box cover from the 80s, but this is 1983. It is about a drama/fan film club in a college here in Los Angeles. And they decide that they're going to have this kind of film fest and they bring out this long-running vampire actor. He's very much played like a combination of like Bela Lugosi and Peter Cushing, where he's this very much like classically trained. I worked with Sir Laurence Olivier and played, you know, I was in this and this and did this with Orson going back. This like classically trained actor. But what he has become known for is all of these kind of vampiric roles, very much like Bela Lugosi. He's very refined. He's very much kind of full of himself. But at the same time, he definitely is spending his latter years thinking that no one remembers who he is. Until his name is Konrad Razkov. Until this group of film students decide to hold a festival and they invite him out to talk. And he drops dead of a heart attack on stage. And so then they have this massive funeral for him. They put him in this amazing mausoleum. And his widow decides to have this kind of psychic event for him where she tries to reach out to the other side. Simultaneous to her trying to reach him on the other side through the use of a psychic, the film students decide that the best way to pay tribute to him is to break into his tomb, steal the body, and take it to their house to party with them. And so it gets real Weekend at Bernie's.
Isn't the tomb is very like...
it's Videodrome.
Yeah, yeah. And it's got all sorts of traps and...
Yeah, because he wants his mausoleum to be kind of a tourist attraction. Yeah. So as you walk in, he appears and starts delivering messages and it laughs and all this stuff. So they decide to smash the skylight in, steal his corpse, and take it to their house. Right at the same time, his widow is doing this kind of psychic occult incantation to try to bring him back from the grave. And now that he's in their house, he does come back from the grave as a vampire. And then he spends the rest of the movie hunting all of the college students in their house that have stashed him there as a vampire. And
there's a young upcomer who appears in this movie who I think has potential in this genre. His name is Jeffrey Combs.
It is.
He's like Combs really, it's like one of those, it might even be his first appearance, and it's kind of like obnoxious kind of character, but
yep,
it was so cool.
Very obnoxious character.
I think I asked Jeff about this title once, and he just did not want to talk about this director from memory.
Yeah, the film is rough. To give you some indication, this has been released by Troma and Vinegar Syndrome. So the one that is streaming.
Their powers combined,
thus you get Frightmare. The one that is streaming online right now is the Troma release. It still has like the Michael Herz, Lord Kaufman titling up at the top. Vinegar Syndrome, I believe, did some type of physical copy. But it's spoofy. It does have some really cool kills. It doesn't hold back on the blood or anything like that. The setup is fun. This is definitely a completionist title that I was glad I finally saw because I had not seen this one
previously.
Plus,
you want to see all the Frightmares. There's two Frightmares.
Yeah, I
see. Peter Watkins one.
I'd seen the prior Frightmare,
which is whatever the guy's
far
name,
more brutal and, kind of a little bit more
it's
my jam.
Old people, crazy, killing people.
Crazy
in their
old
house,
people, yeah. This one is not. And this does have amazing set deck because it is a horror film about fanboys and one fangirl. The other ones kind of just seem to be hanging out with their boyfriends, but there is one girl there that they establish is like a huge fan. But since it is, we'll call them fan kids. You do see kind of this 80s collector mentality, which is not exactly what we see today, but they did decorate their house to look as if 80s fangirls and boys. So it's very kind of Morgan Stewart-ish.
Love Morgan Stewart.
We all love Morgan Stewart. Shockwaves approved. So it definitely has that. And according to everything I read today, they outfitted their house to look like fangirls and boys with Fori Ackerman stuff.
Oh, yeah,
wow.
So yeah, so that was kind of the coolest thing. So that's Frightmare 1983.
Wow. I did see one thing that I forgot to mention last week, and I'll just talk about it very briefly. Dave Parker, a friend of the show, he came over and we watched Mike Flanagan's director's cut for Dr. Sleep.
I've heard it's amazing.
It's excellent. It's just, here's the thing.
Tell me too much in it because I've been planning to do this.
And here's the thing. I really couldn't because it's the differences are so subtle that I almost – like basically we had to say, I think that's new. I think that's new. But we weren't sure. It's mostly the pacing is slightly different. It feels much more novelesque. And in fact, it actually has chapter one, chapter two,
cool. like the Shining,
sections you're in. So there's not anything too significant other than letting some of these scenes breathe out more. And as much as I loved it the first time, this is a movie that absolutely is so much richer on repeat viewings, especially this director's cut. The one thing I will say is – the sequence at the Overlook, which you should basically know the finale takes place there. The extended part of that, and you'll know it, is so good.
Okay, cool.
That I'm actually like bummed it wasn't in the movie.
Was it cut just for running time, do you think?
I guess so, but I'll just say that Danny's interaction with a certain character is much longer, and where it goes is so cool.
Oh,
like
cool.
It's so good.
Okay. I don't usually get into like even Midsommar. I'm not rushing to see the long version. I don't.
No, I'm not either. Yeah.
But this one I want to see because even when I saw it in theater, even though I really liked Dr. Sleep in theaters, there was something about it where I felt like, oh, I could have seen more. Like there was just this feeling that maybe there's a little bit missing. I can't explain it, but that was my reservation when I left. Otherwise, I still really liked it.
And you know what? A lot of it is like when I watched it, just thinking from an editor's mind because I've done that before too. Is just literally like. Scenes go on just a little bit longer with a few bits of more dialogue that you think to yourself, I can understand why they lost that. It doesn't really do anything for the plot of the movie you're watching, but it does enrich the characters the way a novel does when you're reading it and you get a little bit more personal time with them. So I think it's excellent. It's, you know, again, it was pretty much our favorite movie last year.
Yeah.
Director's Cut is probably the one I will always revisit at this point.
And speaking of which, with King, I think we're all up to date on The Outsider.
The
best thing
Two more to go.
The best thing going on TV. If it sticks, I wrote to Dick the other night, it's like, if this sticks to landing, if the last episode's great, this will go down as an all-timer series. Like,
yes, it's pretty close.
True Detective
I'm worried
season
that
one
people
was similar.
Aren't watching it, though, because like even, you know, like water cooler discussions with my fellow professors at USC, none of them are watching this.
Well,
and even my
out.
Students, none of them are watching
it. But that's a second-rate school. What do you think? I'm like, my school, everyone's talking about The Outsider.
So, yeah, I'm worried that not enough people are watching it. So please be telling people about The Outsider.
I think the word of mouth is pretty good.
It's been great.
I just love seeing Ben Mendelsohn in that lead role. Playing not playing a villain for a change. Yeah. Playing like, he's so good.
Well, speaking, I mean, it's not horror, but between Outsider and McMillions, I have been living on HBO. Are you guys watching McMillions?
No, but I've heard about it.
Oh my God.
It's a podcast too.
It's melting my brain. There's only like one episode left.
I've been obsessed
with it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I saw one that I think would be a Becca title, and I'm not sure if you've seen this one. One of our listeners from Sweden, Norway.
She probably recommended to you like five episodes ago.
I'm going to go with 5 years
let me
ago.
See. This is probably going to – next to Anthropophagus is the hardest
title. Am I going to bang my head into the wall?
Senin Tunchi, Curse of the Alps. So that Senatucci.
You got me here.
Okay, cool. Chris, it reminds me of
Senatucci.
Senatucci. It's long. It's basically like a witch demon thing that you invoke. So it's set in the, I think it's Norwegian Alps. Basically, there's three kind of goat herder type characters stuck in a cabin.
You had me at goat herders.
Yeah, exactly.
You sure do know my movie taste.
So it's a goat herder movie, but sexy, which is actually true, believe it or not, because Roxanne Mesquita, who I think is one of the sexiest women alive from Kiss of the Damned and Fat Girl, the French actress, she ends up being in this. So basically, there's this myth that, or this kind of legend that these three guys are up in this cabin. If they take a broom, some straw, and some old rags, they invoke the Senatucci at night because they're so isolated and they're these three men. It'll turn into the most beautiful woman on earth. She'll grant all their desires, and the next day they will all wake up murdered and like straw filling their bodies, basically. This is this curse, right? So on one hand, you have this kind of giallo setup where a body in the opening scene is found and cops find it and they go, I wonder how this happened. And then we start to get this whole Senatucci story. And at the same time as that story is happening up in the hills on the ground level, a beautiful woman, mysterious woman just shows up after there's been a murder. And so the town people think it's her. That's this Roxanne Mesquita. And she ends up mistiming her arrival to a certain cabin with three men who have just called for a Senatucci, and she is not one, but has wandered in at the exact moment they have invoked it. So they think she is their pleasure creature, and it becomes this very fucked up thing. But this is
Can you spell Senatucci? Because I'm sitting here frantically Googling it.
S-E-N-N-E-N-T-U-N-T. And then it'll be on, like, if you look it up on, and then Curse of the Alps. But I know for a fact that one of our listeners once recommended this to us on one of the sites. And I was like, I've never even heard of that. I think it's like 2007 or something.
This is a recent
But it doesn't feel like it. It feels like a 70s giallo style in terms of the...
It's on Prime.
Yeah, it is on Prime. That's where I watched it. I think it's really good. It's like a pretty entertaining, strange story. It's just a surprising one that it's... besides the one person who recommended it, hadn't even heard this title. And I like anything that's about a new kind of myth and a new story that you haven't quite heard before. Also, just as a throwaway, I also watch Super Dark Times again on a screen at work because I brought in the writers, Luke Petrosky and Ben Collins, and students really loved it. I loved seeing it again. Hadn't seen it for, you know, a couple of years, and that film holds up. It's a really interesting coming of age film if you haven't seen it.
By the way, that last one, because send it to two, it's pretty hard.
Yeah, you don't have to.
Search Curse of the Alps, you'll find it.
Okay, Curse of the Alps.
And it's on Prime.
Does it say what country it's from? I can't remember if it's like Norway, Sweden. I feel like it's shot where opera ends and phenomena is set. That's how it feels. It's that landscape where
nice.
You know
is
what
it
I mean?
Dutch?
Yeah, it could be like Amsterdam or something.
Yeah, maybe.
It's somewhere like that, but it's very rural.
I watched, and I'm not going to talk about it much just because it was not exactly horror, but I watched The White Reindeer from 1952.
You
would like
that.
This.
Yeah, I
want to
see that. That sounds
yeah,
cool.
It's definitely more kind of a fantasy mystical thing with a couple of horror notes about shamans and stuff and mythos of the area. But yeah, you would like that one, Eric. But the next one I'll talk about here. So I've been, for Nightmare U, I've been working my way through a lot of the Tartan Asia Extreme titles.
Oh, man.
And so,
I missed that label.
I know, cool label. So good. And I've rewatched so many of them, just within the past couple of weeks. But one that I thought I had seen before, but I had never seen before, is 2002's Phone. And I remembered, I kept thinking that I had seen it. This is South Korean. And I remembered, after I started watching it, that I didn't watch it because I thought it looked like a One Missed Call ripoff. And it turns out that this is, it predecesses One Missed Call. So this actually happened before it. This is fun. It felt like a Lifetime film, like a crazy bonkers, like domestic drama Lifetime film where they keep getting like really fucked up phone calls that make them go bonkers. And so the setup is just that this woman is a journalist. She has just, kind of unmasked this notorious pedophile. And, she's now fearing for her safety because these other people who are part of the ring are after her. And she keeps getting these really threatening phone calls. So she calls up her best friend, is like, yo, can I come stay with you? And her best friend's like, yeah, come on over. And so she's staying in her best friend's like massive mansion while they're away. And then the phone calls start back up. And it's not on her phone anymore. She's now using an unlisted phone. But the phones, the calls just get bonkers, like completely weird. And then other people around her start getting the phone calls. And anytime somebody gets a phone call, they kind of then lose their shit. And it's fun. I had a blast with this one. I also have to give it some accolades because I haven't seen this from a lot of the Asian horror films that were on the Tartan label. It's super self-contained. 90% of the movie is just her alone in this house with four other people drifting in and out. Like the entire cast is maybe five people. So super, super self-contained. This was actually purchased by Imprint Media in 2009 with intentions of remaking it. This is the same company that did the Stepfather reboot and all the Twilight films. They obviously did not, but yeah, it just feels like, One Missed Call as a Lifetime film. Hmm. It was super fun.
The one I want to watch is Infection. That's one you've talked about a bunch.
I love that one.
And I've never saw that one. Tartan is a great label. And because there were so many different types of movies on there, like my favorite was a film called The Isle but just like, it's not a horror film. It's just like a very dark, weird sex thing, but there's so many different titles. Yeah.
So I still have copies of most of the Tartan Extreme. And this is what prompted me to talk about it on the show. When Tartan Asia was merging with, I can't even remember what company they merged with, Genius, or they merged with a company right around 2009, they had to get rid of all of their old DVD stock that had the old logo on it. So they called me up, and at the time we did all of these drives for fund subscription drives for Fango, where like if you subscribe and get 2 years and pay in advance, we'll send you like two free DVDs. And so Tartan called me up and they were like, do you want these? We can't do anything with them. We can't sell them anymore because it's the wrong logo on the back. Do you want these to give away with Fango subscription drives?
Yeah, right.
And I said, sure. And she said, give me your address. And at the time it was when I was doing my year of graduate work in Richmond, Virginia. And I was like, cool, here's my address. I live in an apartment. And she was like, cool, I'll have it delivered. Is there like a doorstep I can put it on? I was like, yeah, you can just leave it on the doorstep. I'll get it when I get home. I come home from school. They delivered a pallet, like thousands of DVDs. Yeah. There was literally one of those wooden pallets with like crates of them in it on my apartment doorstep. And then I ended up having to get a storage unit because I was like building furniture out of them in my apartment. And so there was a good 2 year stretch where if you subscribed to Fango, you received one of those Tartan DVDs, which was sent out of my apartment in Richmond.
So cool.
But I still have most of them. So I have a copy of just about all of the Tartan movies.
I have a handful because they were the company that put out the Chanwook Park movies, like Old Boy and City of the Immersive Vengeance and all that. And so I was buying them as they came out. And then when Tower Records went out of business and they were like marking everything down 50%, I like bought off whatever Tartan stuff I didn't have, like Coma. I still have that in my DVD collection. Yeah, there are a lot of really, a lot of interesting Whispering Corridors.
And Wishing Stairs.
Wishing Stairs, yes.
So good.
And there's a box set with those.
Yeah, the Chanwook Park Thirst I rewatched last week as well.
Kino Lorber just put
a guy in a taxi driver.
Perth.
Perth.
It's Perth. Singapore.
Yeah. That's a good
Perth.
Yeah,
I talked about that. So if you listen to my Deep Cuts episode this week, it's about Perth.
Do I have to be a Patreon member?
You do.
But doing a show with you, it feels wrong. That I would pay money
you will pay to hear me talk about Perth.
Because if I go there to not listen to your recommendation, what's going to happen then? Then you're going to really be mad at me.
No, Perth is awesome.
No, I remember
seeing it. Not exactly
on
a horror film, but it really is. It's like Taxi Driver, but it's very much about Singaporean society and social classes. And that's a really good one.
Yeah. And it's funny. I think that it's underrated when you put these things under one label because people notice the label. Otherwise, these things are floating around on their own and sometimes fall through the radar. I think that's the power of like having somewhere to kind of culminate these kind of movies.
Well, you know, and it sucks now because the physical media side has kind of died down. But like for modern time, or at least the last decade, it's Well Go USA. It was kind of where I was getting all my South Korean cinema.
Yeah.
Like post Tartan. Yeah. So yeah, you're right. I wish there were more labels that created the stuff.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say I saw, because it's going to segue directly in, I saw the documentary Blood and Flesh.
Yes.
What's after that? The Ghastly?
It is called Blood.
I don't want to blow that.
Oh, shit. I thought I had it up on my screen and I have the box set up instead.
Well, it's the Al Adamson documentary.
Blood and Flesh.
Yes.
The real life and ghastly death of Al Adamson.
And real as in R-E-E-L,
yes.
Because it's about his life and film. But because, like, this is one of the first stories when I think I was 20, I know where I was. I was 21. I'd come to L.A. to study film in Irvine, and I remember turning on the news and seeing the story about his murder and thinking, oh, my God, this is the great – like, I didn't really know who he was. I'd heard of, like, Planet of the Blood Vampires or something, and I was like, oh, my God, this horror director's been murdered in the most sensational way. And I'm like, oh, my God, that'd make a great biopic. That's all that was going through my brain at 20. And this documentary really humanizes the person, goes through his incredible and strange odyssey through film, which is fascinating. And yeah. I love documentaries that just go film by film, showing how he became this filmmaker. Also, didn't realize his dad came from my part of the world, which was a fun surprise.
With Westerns.
With Westerns, Said New Zealand, and then one son said Australia, so I'm going to have to find out where he's actually from.
We'll ask David in a few minutes.
Yes, because they're not interchangeable, believe it or not. It's not like Jersey and Long Island. Anyway.
That's fighting words there.
But I really love this film, and so I'm really happy that it connects with our guest. And he really is one of the best in the business at doing what often are behind, you know, often extra features, but in this case, it's its own film.
Well, you know, he made a name for himself with, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, A Family Portrait. It was one of the earliest documentaries of its sort.
And to this day, my favorite is the Joe Spinell story.
The Joe Spinell story.
Yes. I think it's a beautiful portrait. Good. Yeah.
And of course, Lost Soul,
I show in my intro to film class every year because it's such a fun, just fascinating lesson into how movies go wrong.
Especially studio. At the studio level,
like,
what can happen?
No matter how much money you're throwing at something, nothing is going to save the ship from sinking.
By the way, best fact about that, Richard Stanley, which I didn't know until Mick Garris's podcast did it.
Oh, with Richard, yeah.
Well, because, you know, he obviously disappeared from the business for 20 years and like was living in a cave in France or whatever. He mentioned on, I've never heard this before. He told Mick that Island Doctor Moreau, even though he got canceled, he got fired off of it, he had a pay or play deal on it.
Oh. So he got paid.
He got paid his director fee, which is millions of dollars in that movie, regardless of not doing it. And I'm like, that's how he lives it.
And that also makes us cry a little less.
A little less. Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. It was a technicality.
So he can comfortably live
in a cave in
France.
He should have never gotten it, but it was just in the paperwork.
I won't shed meteorite tears for him from his mother that healed her blindness. I won't. If you listen to enough of the podcast with Richard, you'll hear some pretty amazing stories about the tears of meteorite blood that cured his mother's blindness, where I was just my jaws on the ground listening to some of his stories.
He told me I had a great aura, guys.
A great aura.
I've always thought about that. Becca. That aura
great
is something.
Aura. Yeah.
Wow.
And you can see Becca's aura on Fandor.
Now, by the way, this documentary that you're talking about, we're going to delve into it with David, but it is available digitally right now.
Yeah, that's how I watched it.
You can actually watch
it,
yes.
He sent us a screening link, and I didn't want to watch on my computer, so I paid for it on Amazon. I felt good about it.
Way to go.
I know.
Way to go.
It was like $3. It was nothing.
All right. Well, let's hear from our sponsors again. Let's bring on Severin Films' David Gregory.
Cool. Let's rock and roll.
Horror fans, NabNew.com is your new destination for keeping up with the latest horror collectibles. At launch, NAB is aggregating 27 of the top online stores into a place so you can find a new release of DVDs, toys, figures, comics, vinyl soundtracks, board games, and more. Simply follow your favorite horror properties and you'll get a custom feed with all of the day's new releases that matter to you. And since we have everything in one place, you can easily compare prices across vendors, check stock availability, and nab it before it's gone. NAB is more than just horror. You can follow everything from American Psycho to My Hero Academia. So we put together a special collection for Shockwaves fans. Visit nabnew.com/horror to check it out. That's nabnew, nabnew.com/horror.
This week's episode is also sponsored by RLJE Films. Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space starring Nicolas Cage is now available on 4K UHD, Blu-ray, DVD, and digital. Own it now on Amazon.com and experience the color with Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space.
It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria vaults. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table-worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and the weird cinema to custom. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you are looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online today at DiabolikTVD.com.
All right, we are back and we are sitting in the office of Jim Koons, right above the Severin Films office with
the most ghastly guest.
No, he's lovely. He's not ghastly.
He's fantastic.
For a British
guys.
Person, he's wonderful.
Welcome back, David Gregory.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Can we talk about that Kathy's Chris moment again?
I know.
I'm
going to try and recreate it.
We may have that moment tonight. You may say a title that nobody would imagine. Okay. And he's going to be like, yep, it's on the slate.
But I feel like I'd be cheating if I did this time.
Let me just say how much I love having David Gregory on, because he's one of the people that I love talking about exploitation films with, because he matches my exuberance for them. Yeah. So like we can be talking about Beast in Heat and you're just smiling and happy. And I'm like, yeah, right. And it's just, it's everything I love.
Now, it wasn't you did Beast in the Cellar?
Beast That's in the Cellar.
Both Beast in Heat and Beast in the Cellar.
Yeah. Now, did you hear my story with Josh Miller about Beast in the Cellar?
No.
Or no? I'll tell you, this is actually pretty funny. So a couple of weeks ago, I went to his place to do VHS night. And I'd forgotten this feeling. He had a bunch of VHS. He tossed them out. I brought a bunch over. We looked at the covers. There was one with this amazing like zombie face that's falling apart on the cover. And we're like, well, that's the one, right? Like, we got to watch that. And we put it on. And like 15 minutes in, we're just sitting there. And it looks terrible. And Josh is like, it's just like two old ladies talking for 15 minutes. What are we watching?
Very good actresses.
Yes. Yeah. Well, very good actresses, but not the zombie cover that we were expecting. And it was Jim actually who messaged me saying, hey, you know, you could watch a Blu-ray of that. And I was like, holy shit, I own the Blu-ray of this because Severin put it out, and that was Beast in the Cellar.
Mm-hmm. You'd have been better off with Beast in Heat.
Yes,
Beast in Heat is a much different movie. It's much very harder to get through, but things happen.
Yeah, Beryl Reed is not in that one.
Okay.
Yeah. What was of all the titles you put out, what was the one that you got most personally excited about? Not like obviously it's you have your George C. Scott Like that seems like a coup, and it's The Changeling's a wonderful film. But what was the thing that you were just like giddy about? Oh my God, we have.
There's been many because a lot of them are films that you know I want to revisit and restore and do that kind of thing. And I mean, Santa Sangre is probably the ultimate one because we worked for many years to get the rights to that one, and they just became available after Anchor Bay had done their box set of Jodorowsky films, and we were there to get them. And actually, we're redoing it now because we've done a 4K scan of the negative. And I just spoke to Mr. Jodorowsky yesterday. About approving that master.
Do you fanboy?
Well, he's quite intimidating. Yeah. And but actually, no, he was very nice. I mean, he wanted to go into the a color studio because we'd already done a full color correction pass. And it's actually already screened in a few places, but his sons saw it in two different spots and said, although it looks good, there's a few tweaks that make it different from the original. And what's different is that the previous Blu-ray was approved by the director of photography, and it had quite muted colors, but because it was approved by the director of photography, what are you going to do? He's the director of photography. But it's not how I remembered it. And there were certainly a few people said that it should be a much more vibrant movie. Huh. So anyway, when we got the opportunity to revisit it and scan the negative in 4K, we jumped at it. And now Mr. Jodorowsky is going to approve the master in Paris.
Do you think he'll live to be 300 like he talks about in the film? Because if anyone could, it's
probably going to be him. Yeah,
you know. Why was he recently? Holly Mountain, maybe at Beyond Fest a couple years ago, and I remember just seeing him walk by, going, "How the hell is this guy?" I remember being this little kid just seeing a book about El Topo, and here's this guy walking by us, looking just $1 million. You know, so cool. But yeah, that title's a special one. But the answer was Things. I was waiting for you to naturally come.
Another one I would say is Bloody Moon, because Bloody Moon was one that my business partner Carl and I saw when we were very young. And we watched it. We were probably about 11 years old. And we had to pretend we were playing a board game in the living room while our parents were in the other room. And that's what we were doing, not watching Bloody Moon. But it was also the same day that we watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first time. So it was a very special day.
And Bloody Moon's much gorier.
Yes, it is. We came out of it saying we've seen two of the best movies ever made.
So you and Carl go way back.
We do too. I think we met when we were about 8 years old.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
And I thought you met on the show when you came on our show. It's so special.
First time meeting.
We did that.
That was cool that he was here, though, because he's not in the U.S. that often.
No, he's still back in Nottingham where we grew up.
Oh, wow.
That's really cool. Well, there's so much to tackle and get into. We have already got a scoop right there about Santa Sangre, but let's start with the main reason we're here, which is the Al Adamson documentary that is now available digitally, right? And it'll be part of the box set, which is coming in April?
Correct, yes.
And so Elric and I watch it. Becca, have you had a chance to check
it out? I have not. I'm excited to.
It's very interesting because from our perspective, because you were familiar with his films, and I'm not ashamed to say, Al Adamson is a complete blind spot for me. I was not
including
familiar.
The murder? Including his?
Including the murder.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know about him.
I didn't know about the movies. Nothing. Interesting. So watching this doc was really – it's exciting because I can't believe – I mean – how many films are in the box? 35 or something like that?
32, including Blood and Flesh. Yeah.
So that's a lot of movies that I've never seen.
Let's say they're 32 feature presentations, because a couple of them are the same movie which they shot new footage for and re-released as completely different films. And they are completely different films, but they decided they didn't work as Psycho A Go-Go, went back and shot some horror footage and then changed it.
So if it's 32, it's really like 90, because he picks from so many movies. but there is things about him. Yeah, so most people, if they're familiar at all, it's maybe with a couple of his films and, you know, the E! True Hollywood Story. Because for someone like him to get one of those, I felt like, oh my God, this very obscure director being featured on a show that was very mainstream about his death. But what I like about the film is you don't want to – just like I think what Quentin achieved this year with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is making Sharon Tate someone who wasn't just a murder victim anymore, wasn't just a punchline in a negative way.
Yeah, the exploitation.
It was like, let's look at the person's life and the time. And I felt that about this. I felt like, and also I think sometimes Al Adamson's name has been used in the same way Ed Woods has to be like, bad director. Alan, this was like so fascinating because you went film by by film through his thing, how he got into the business, his father, who kind of, you know, this whole segue, and then seeing this guy that everyone liked, and they even talk when he's bad. Like, I love the one guy you've got who every time goes, oh, his films are terrible. Like, he didn't know what the fuck he was, you know, yeah. the one guy who's helping him make movies, yeah.
But didn't, and I have not seen the documentary, yeah. but he worked with such good people, like, and I'm going to say his name wrong, the same cinematographer who did The Sadist, Zilmos.
Vilmos Zsigmond.
Thank you. And, that guy. Yeah. Like, he is, did a
he's
couple
in
of
the
his,
documentary.
Oh, that is yes. awesome.
No, it's amazing to see him in there. Vilmos and Nestor Alamandra. Is it Nestor?
No. Laszlo Kovacs.
Laszlo Kovacs, right.
And Vilmos died 4 years ago, five years ago, something like that. So we got hit. We actually snuck the interview at the end of an interview about Heaven's Gate. Yeah. And but credit to him, he was happy to talk about
Al Adamson's
Al
movies
Adamson.
Were more yeah. successful than Heaven's Gate. And that is the most amazing thing that you could ever make. But it is loving in that way that it starts to build a portrait of a person and a love affair that was very important in his life, which I found very moving.
And so
it becomes more than that. And then you get into what happened to him because you have to, you know, it's so fascinating to know how that all went down.
Well, and even how emotional people in his life still to this day get about what happened to him. I'm just curious because, again, it was a blind spot for me. But why, when you tackle a documentary, I could say this as a documentarian myself, it kind of takes the life out of you. It's like you really have to love the subject and really believe in it. So what was it about Al Adamson that you felt – what was the seed that was like, yeah, this is a story I want to tell?
After doing Lost Soul as a feature, because I do many featurettes and still do for bonus features on our own discs and other companies' discs, you're looking for a story that's worthy of a feature, not just a celebration of, you know, a cult movie maker or a particular film or something like that. And so I was actually here in this very room interviewing David Conow, who'd written a book called Schlockerama about Al Adamson. It was because we'd picked up the rights to one Al Adamson film, and I just thought, let's do an extra about Al Adamson for that film, Carnival Magic. And of course, as he was talking and telling the various stories, just in a kind of a skeleton of the stories, I was thinking, you know, obviously, or it's not just the fact that there is a grisly true crime aspect at the end of it, although that does lend an angle that's not in your usual filmmaker bio, but also all the characters that are in his life, you know, John Bug Cardos, who went on to be a director in his own right, Gary Kent, the stuntman, who was partially the inspiration for Brad Pitt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and that story about him going to the Spahn Ranch and beating up Tex Watson, you know.
Because there is a Manson touch point in this film.
I don't know why I didn't connect that. That's
Gary Graver.
Yeah, Gary Graver, the director.
Who shot with Orson Welles
at the same time. Xandor Vorkov, who played Dracula in Dracula vs. Frankenstein, had never been interviewed before. And it was exactly that. I spoke to him on the phone and said, you know, the various television documentaries about Al are very much more obsessed with the fact that he had a spectacular death. Yeah. And, you know, that's how true crime shows are. Yeah. But for me, you know, I'd grown up watching his movies, Dracula versus Frankenstein with being a particular favorite, and another one that I watched early on when Carl and I used to rent videos that our parents didn't approve of. And it was that I wanted to explore as well. That's why we start the movie with talking about the sensational aspect and then go back and talk about the person who made this movies and all his roller coaster of adventures in low budget filmmaker, which aren't, you know, always positive. Not everybody is like, oh, this was a great time. It's not hagiography, but there's definitely a lot of stories about, you know, how you get a movie to the finish line, you know, when you've got very little resources.
I took issue. I was talking before you get here. I have some real issues that in the opening of this movie, they're talking about his father. And one person goes, yeah, he's from New Zealand. The next three say he's from Australia.
Right.
I will never know. How am I going to find out the truth? Where was he from, do you think?
Australia? He was from New Zealand, but he got famous in Australia.
So like Russell Crowe and many before
both
him.
Both answers are right.
But that was fascinating because I didn't know Al was born into a family of showmen. I did not know that was part of his trajectory. And so I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, and he like Al, was somebody who was very much an independent. So he was making silent Western movies. He was kind of a huckster in that he basically ripped off Tom Mix, the big silent movie cowboy star, and made a character called Art Mix and made all these movies, got sued by Tom Mix and got away with it. And he used to bicycle his films around the country and showing them. And a lot of them are lost because he would just have, you know, the handful of prints and take them until they fell apart. Mm.
Did you learn about the murder itself? Did you learn stuff that, you know, that you obviously learned stuff you didn't know before, but did you feel like you guys were uncovering anything that was less familiar to people? Obviously it's cool to have the police involved so you can hear how the takedown worked. Yeah. Obviously you have shocking to me was you actually have the voice of the killer, which is something pretty big deal.
Which was an 11th hour addition.
Okay.
And something we were trying to get throughout the process. The movie took about 3.5 years from that first interview to when it premiered. And it was new to do and interesting as a filmmaker to do something that was in that true crime genre because I hadn't done that before. And doing things like finding the housekeeper and the police, which with the help of Heather Buckley, we were able to track down various people and a private investigator in order to fight. Because unlike, you know, film people, they're not generally in the phone book or the phone book. They're not generally
on to be anymore.
Fucking phone book. Yeah. but you know what I'm saying. So that was interesting. But then also dealing with the police department and what what they will give you access to was quite eye opening. And they had that footage of the drilling the floor, which was during a very brief period where the Indio Police Department used video cameras in such situations. Because usually, and to this day, they only use still photography, but they went through a 1 year period where they actually filmed situations like that, where they went into the house to try and find a missing person. And so we got access to that footage.
Interesting.
Well, and I mean, obviously that part of the story is interesting, but to me it's more I'm excited about discovering these films that I'd never seen before. At what point in the process did this become a box set? Because you said you had one film, right? And then you're doing a documentary about him. So when did it become possible?
What happened was we started talking to Sam Sherman, his partner, and he became the real treasure trove of the information and the archive and the rights to a lot of these movies. And a great storyteller and a fascinating man in his own right. And so when we decided to – we licensed, I think, Dracula vs. Frankenstein and Satan Sadist, the two most famous, arguably, films that he made first, and then – we went to interview him and it was hours and hours of stuff. And then we went into his basement where he has his own archive of things. And just as we got into, restoring the first ones, then we're like, well, let's do a handful more because if we're doing this documentary, let's put out some of his other films. And the more he started to investigate where his elements were, the more we were like, well, he's found a couple of reels of this one here, and there's an archive over there that should have the negative of that and that kind of stuff. And it became a whole archaeological dig of finding all these movies. Like Psycho A Go-Go, for example, does not exist as a negative as Psycho A Go-Go because they cut it up to make Fiend with the Electronic Brain and then later Blood of Ghastly Horror. And so, but they have the outs from Psycho A Go-Go, so we can put that back together. And once we started doing that, we're like, well, we may as well add this lot to the pile, because if we're actually going back to these labs and storage spaces that you have while you're opening the vault, we may as well get that stuff. We've got a scanner, a film scanner at the Severin office, that we now have the opportunity to try and get as much of this stuff archived as possible.
One major question I have after watching this, and I want you to only give a yes or no answer for your own safety. Aliens?
I'm saying nothing.
I need more explanation. Sorry.
You need to watch.
No, but there's an interesting angle through this that it's like sometimes you watch somebody who goes, oh, that person seems like a crank talking about aliens. What's interesting, the documentary, there's just a sequence. I'm not going to give it away for people, but there's a sequence where you start to actually believe it just because there's a group of different people being interviewed who just gets so nervous about this question that I started to believe what I was watching. I was curious, without ruining it for people, did you get any sense? Obviously, you're also talking to them off air, but did you get any sense of what that was about? Or
I got the sense that they genuinely believed what they were talking about.
They genuinely believed that there's some conspiracy out there. Yeah.
And this is basically all to do with a film that Al was making when he was murdered. Yeah. And there's enough footage, according to Sam Sherman, to make 2 or 3 movies called Beyond This Earth. And it was an alien project. Sam was the one who was into aliens and is a believer and had been doing, you know, audio documentaries for years before they actually decided to make this into a movie. So it was very much his project. But his wife had died. So he was trying to get Al back into filmmaking and not, you know, become the recluse that he had become. And so he got Al involved, and then Al just got deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And certainly it was that some weird things happened around around talking about that as well, which, you know, were kind of funny, but also kind of creepy.
Well, also, and just the fact that it's timings at a similar time as his murder, even though the murder seems very cut and dry, you know, and for all accounts in terms of the behavior of the criminal does not exactly seem innocent.
Yeah.
It is very strange timing when you have people that paranoid about something like that.
It's
eerie
to
watch it.
It is. I mean, they basically stopped work on it for a while because they were like, okay, we're getting too deep. People are watching. People don't want you talking about this kind of
thing. This documentary is amazing.
This sounds so heavy.
Well, and what's cool is the first hour or in a bit is a very different kind of film. It's that kind of film where you get film by film, you get to learn about the person. And then there are like two or three more kind of types of movie in there. And I like those kind of movies. I like where you get to hit all these different kind of tones.
Yeah, well, it was that was sort of part of the trick was that it takes a very severe left turn in the at the third act part, you know, because
like his life.
Yeah, exactly. And it's definitely fun filmmaking shenanigans. Unlike, you know, many others. I mean, the tricks that they got up to get these movies made and completed and into theaters are pretty fascinating in themselves. But then it takes a turn for sure.
What, you know, I imagine you've seen most of the movies that you're going to be putting out.
Yes.
Is there a gem amongst them that you weren't aware of? Like once you start having to, I mean, I know when I say gem and even the fact that you call this the Masterpiece Collection, right? I think it's just hilarious.
We call it the Masterpiece Collection because the only other box set in the history of home video that's anything like this comprehensive is the Bergman set.
Yeah, I know.
From
right?
Criterion. Yeah. So, you know, masterpiece is subjective.
Yeah.
But it's safe to say that these films probably would have been lost if you had not done this.
Because one of them is lost. The one that the annoyance that we didn't get Lash of Lust into the box is frustrates me because I am in touch with the producer. He's still around, but he has no recollection of where, you know, any prints of this movie wasn't widely released. But no, there are several of his movies that I'm very fond of. I mean, I like Angels Wild Women was one of the ones that I didn't know before we did this that I thought was really cool. I always love Dracula versus Frankenstein for its lunacy. I actually think Satan's Sadist is a genuinely good biker movie.
It is.
You've got a great story about how Tarantino knew it. All the dialogue of the
Rust Hamblin
monologue. Yeah. And that's a great story. Yeah. Like, because these movies, that's a great thing. It's like we always say, every movie is somebody's favorite movie and somebody's quoting dialogue of the movie that somebody else just thinks the worst piece of shit.
And Rust Hamblin thought he was fucking with him. He's like, not that movie of all my movies.
The one that looked interesting to me was the Western with all woman. It was like an all woman Western that looked like Bad Girls, but you know, a long time ago.
Jesse's Girls.
Yeah, that looked interesting.
Yeah. That one's good too.
Yeah.
That one's good too. That was not a Sam Sherman production. Like Al in the 70s would also branch out and do like Black Samurai, for example.
Yeah, that's
a very fun movie with Black Belt Jones, Jim Kelly.
Jim Kelly flying through the air on the. Yeah, that looked interesting. Yeah.
But the only title I recognized, and it wasn't even legit, is I Spit on Your Corpse.
Yes.
Which I didn't realize was one of his movies because it's not what it was.
That's
it was
Girls for Rent. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's so funny.
And now is that film, the documentary, also part of the box set?
The documentary is part of the box set.
Okay. Yeah. So if you get the box, you get
the 30-second movie. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what else is going on.
Because it's been you haven't been on since I think episode like 81 or something.
It was Rob's apartment. I remember. Was I there?
Wasn't that when they announced the Changeling?
Yeah.
But I'm talking about the important one where we talk about the
Kathy's curse. Never mind the Changeling.
I don't think I've ever pulled off quite such a good guess in my life. So I feel still
that is pretty good. Yeah. But no, let's talk about the evolution of Severin since the last time you were on, because I think that's the interesting thing is like, we can't really peg. You're one of the rare labels that I don't know if there's – I can't say like, they do these kind of movies.
Oh, no. You guys will try anything, which I love so much so that like you put out new films like you did Baskin.
Yes.
You'll do older films. And then you also just did like – you've started a kids label too.
Yes. Well, because we picked up the Peanut Butter Solution, which I hadn't seen, but it was recommended to me by Brett Berg from
of course.
It's wild.
And then Kayla Janice, who works with us a lot, was like, oh my God, absolutely. You have to do this.
Right?
Absolutely. And so whenever I mention the peanut butter solution to people, they're like, yep, that's very in line with what Severin does, even though it's a kid's movie.
And so, Kinder Trauma style. Like, yes. It's the kind of film, if you saw it as a kid, it has enough horror beats.
Yeah. Which everybody has those movies. Yeah. Right? Yeah. We even asked the question when we released it, what would you want to see? What was the one that that messed you up? You know, in fact, what the next film that we'll be announcing next week is When the Wind Blows, which is basically Threads for Kids.
Wait, what?
Interesting, I haven't seen
Threads for Kids. Yeah. What a sell.
When the Wind Blows.
Some communist
blows.
Stuff in there.
What is this from? When?
This is from the late 80s. It's a animated film by the guy who did The Snowman, Raymond Briggs, and Fungus the Bogeyman. Yeah. And he basically did a nuclear war film with an old couple.
Oh, God. This looks haunting. They're puppets.
Yeah. No, no, no. They're animated. But but they, it's the same thing. It came out of a few years after Threads.
They don't have faces,
though.
Another one
of your kids' films, Threads.
Okay. They're puppets of the characters that you're looking at there. But there they are. Okay.
They still don't have much faces.
Yeah. No, and they're basically just an old couple who are basically trying to reminiscing about how great World War II was, you know, when you're British.
The good war.
Exactly. War, yeah, exactly. but they have to deal with all the same things that they do in Threads, like set up a shelter in their living room, and the same things happen as it does to the couple in Threads. It's disturbing.
From the producer of Yellow Submarine, so you know what kind of animation you're
Roger Waters did the music, and David Bowie did the title song.
Did you see Threads when it came out on TV?
I did.
In England? What was that like to see that?
Because horrifying.
That to me would just be like, if that played right now in America, where we are right now, you'd be frightened.
Yeah,
because it's such a disturbing and.
It was utterly horrifying, and everybody was talking about it, but kind of in a hushed way, because some people didn't want to tell other people because they didn't want to kind of know. Like parents would talk about it, but not in front of the children because they didn't want the children to really know how dire things were.
So Severin Kids is a thing. If this is a second title, that means that
you actually Carnival Magic is the second title, because we're releasing that outside of the Al Adamson box as well. So Carnival Magic is the second Severin Kids title, and When the Wind Blows will be third. And there's a few more in the pipeline, but we'll see how well.
So I had two recommendations. I think on the website I talked about Dunderklumpen, which was the Scandinavian kids movie that was a combination of animation and live action. I just remembered it had a giant moving mountain that ate kids. Yeah. It was wild. And then Adventures of Mark Twain from 1985. I feel like I couldn't have been the only person to recommend that, which is this claymation with these kids and Mark Twain. And they tour all these different time periods in history, and they visit Satan on the moon, who comes as a theatrical mask and talks about the horrors of humanity and how all men are evil and why men are evil. It's just horrifying.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. The one that everybody mentioned the most was Return to Oz, but obviously it's a Disney film.
Disney.
We can't go anywhere near that.
I have one of the original one sheets from that. Yeah, that totally, because Mombi takes her head off. You've got the Wheelers in it. Yeah, that one fucked me up pretty bad as a kid. Yeah.
But how's it been going? Like, do you see, like, with the brand, obviously, because you're also focused on your own movie, but like, how does the growth, I mean, obviously we were talking to you last before The Changeling, which we all feel is one of the biggest titles in your, catalog.
It's certainly in recent years. It is. It's actually been going quite well. Yeah. I mean, I think our productivity has increased over the last couple of years. We have more people working for us, but it's still, I would say like six or seven of us who are working regularly. I wouldn't even say full time. Everybody's, just absolutely dedicated to getting as many films out as we can, because we've licensed enough movies to get us through the next couple of years.
Oh, cool.
So,
does anyone sell as many as when I stand at your booth?
No,
in Texas?
Absolutely not.
Into total huckster mode and I just stand outside your thing. You go, oh, you got to watch this.
Well, it's funny you say that, because various people have their titles that they, when they're at the table, they want to sell, like Lewis from Massacre Video, when he's at our table, he will sell a copy of Cannibal Terror, to some poor sod.
I think we sold all of your Devil's Honey at Texas Frightmare last year.
A lot of Devil's Honey went that's right. Last year, quite a few things, right?
Last year at Texas Frightmare, Elric came over to your table, took like five copies or something, brought him to our table, was like, we will sell.
That's right.
Yes.
They actually sold better at your table than they did at ours.
Yeah.
It's a lesson, David.
Yeah. we didn't have much on our table, so like, oh,
yeah.
I guess
yeah, we'll sell some saxophones. Yeah. And it'll be cool.
What have been some of the? Well, I don't know. Are you willing to tell us what's coming up?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things that I wrote down that I wanted to mention.
Here we go. We're looking over your shoulder.
I just saw one and I gasped myself.
I want him to do it. I want him to
like,
say
can
that
I guess
loud.
One? Like,
no, don't guess.
Yeah, guess it. Go on. So Cruel Jaws, the Bruno Mattei sharksploitation film, which was also known as Jaws 5.
How? Is this real?
Yes.
Are you going like Vinegar Syndrome where it doesn't matter if you have the rights? Or is it?
We have the rights to Cruel Jaws. No, I mean, it's kind of like, okay. You know, when we did Night Killer with a different cover. Obviously, okay. We wouldn't dream of doing that with Jaws.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3.
Exactly.
Cruel Jaws. It's fun.
Yeah.
It is just
well, Rebecca's
fun.
On the disc.
I am on the disc, geeking out about sharksploitation. I'm excited.
That's where that came from.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah.
The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward.
Oh, my number one giallo. Oh, that's my favorite giallo of all. Okay. We were just on a giallo episode. I love that film so much.
Yeah.
It's also just she has never looked better. I love all the weird psychedelic kind of things they do to the lens whenever they're having these, like where the glass shatters all over her. Mm-hmm. And
that one, I mean, most giallos have some fetishistic, but that one just like leans on and goes with it. And in that, it really is one of the sexiest ones.
That's
it's
what,
like
early
50
Martina,
shades
right?
of gray yes, giallo.
Yes,
yeah.
And it's got like
George
Next.
Hilton.
It's called Next or also yep. The Ripper.
Blade of the Ripper.
Yeah, it's got like three titles. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I really think that's one that I hope people take to because, I mean, all you did, All the Colors of the Dark, and that's a great disc too. So
yeah. Oh, God, I love it.
And great documentary you guys put together for mm-hmm. all that.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, well, so that one, those will be announced in the next couple of weeks, Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward and When the Wind Blows are the next ones. And then the month after that, we have some more gialli, but I'm not going to say what they are at this point, but they're ones that have never been on disc in the US before, or if they have, they certainly haven't been on Blu-ray.
Can I just ask without giving away, is one, am I wearing a shirt?
No, you're not. Not
I told him.
Have you ever tried for this one? Have you ever tried for that one?
We have, yes.
What are you wearing a shirt of?
House of the Laughing Windows.
Yeah. Or gee, that? Where'd you get that shirt?
From Pupi Avati.
Yeah.
by way of Becca.
Yeah.
For Christmas.
That was my Christmas.
But is that one that's just too, is it a rights problem with that one? Because that should get a release. It's such a great film.
Yeah.
I believe it is. Okay. Yeah. So I know we've looked into it in the past, but it has been a while, so you never know.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're showing one of the four that we're bringing out in May at our Severin event next month, which is the Severin Super Shock Film Festival that we did last year. And we don't tell you what we're showing, but we show three features of unreleased titles. And that'll be in Hollywood next month. And there'll be J&B on hand and all kinds of fun stuff. So.
Like downstairs, the J&B.
Oh, yeah, the J&B downstairs and the Severin Cellar. We just introduced the J&B to the Severin Cellar. It seems like an obvious addition.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
We're very happy.
There's a winner
that.
On our end. Any others that you can tell us, or are they all?
Satan's Slave, which is the Indonesian movie.
So good. Sure. That was, I think that
the new one or the original?
Was
the original.
This is the original.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the one I was curious to see after it ended because I was like, oh, I want to see what that was. But it was almost impossible. Even on YouTube, I couldn't find it. A copy at that time.
Yep. No, it's hard to come by.
Okay, yeah. Cool. The reboot soon. Is
or a sequel, I guess.
Sequel.
Technically,
I don't know. It was Shockwaves approved.
Yeah. It's a great remake.
It's very well directed. It reminded me the way James Wan directs movies, where it's like it felt like it was in total control.
It was built around
gags,
set pieces.
You know?
Yeah. It was beautiful.
How is the first one? The original.
The first one's terrific. Okay. I mean,
what is it from? I'm not familiar.
It's a really cult film in that
like
country.
84, something like that.
Wow.
The same director did. It started his horror movie career doing a Indonesian cannibal ripoff called either Savage Terror or Primitives, and it's quite a hokey cannibal movie. But then him and the writer actually showed that they had serious horror movie making chops because they made a bunch of movies over the next decade together, and I think Satan's Slave's probably the pinnacle.
I've just heard from people from that country who have said that's the film from that country, like the horror film that and it's technically like they even reference it at the end of the new film. There's a direct reference to that the people in that first film where it's like it went over our heads because we don't know the reference.
And the guy who made the remake basically cites it as the reason he got into making movies. I mean, it was that influential in Indonesia.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I love it when these ones finally get a good release and, you know, it's totally unknown in the West, but could be a classic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one that you did recently is the Russian film that I know you, Becca, Becca
I love
Jared Rivet love a lot.
It's yeah, I discovered out of bed, actually, when I was in grad school, somebody was saying that Russia had never made horror films.
Isn't that Estonian? And
it's
I guess no, that's the Backpackers Hotel.
What's that? Yeah.
The full title. Yeah, we tried to get that one as well, but for some reason
this one is very much Russian, because it's very critical of the church. Yeah. It's very much like go Russia, motherland type movie. But it feels so Sam Raimi in its setups and how everything is accomplished in its filming style. And it is ultimately a horror comedy. I mean, it's not really presented as that, but there is this very much kind of winking at the audience, which you don't really see in, what, 60s is it?
1967,
mm-hmm. out of Russia.
It even has a little Svankmajer-ish quality. There's a part where they're flying through the air where I'm like, whoa, this got wacky.
Yeah, that's where it gets like really
and
Sam Raimi.
The vampire is so old that his eyelids just hang to the ground and they have to be lifted up.
It's just
minions.
So that's funny and weird and quirky. And I had discovered this in grad school when somebody had, I was like, surely Russia was making horror films in the 60s. And they were like, nope, Russia wasn't making film. And then to find out that this was like completely government ordained because it was so critical of the Catholic Church and really was very pro-Russia, that this was like a fully ordained government movie that they were really proud of. Yeah. And there was actually a reboot of this maybe 8 years ago. Really, really heavy on the digital effects.
Yes.
Which had a Vi remake.
There is a Vi remake. It's
but,
but
it's not even, according to Richard Stanley, it's not even based on the story. It's just Vi in name only.
Yeah, there's a little bit of similarity. Some of the scenes are the same. It's the setup is a cartographer who's going in to kind of investigate this weird town. And so it's a much different setup there. It's got some cool stuff in it, but the it felt like they got like 2/3 of the way and then quit. Like it was almost there. Mm-hmm. And then the effects, just some of them fall really flat. But yeah.
Like, how is it getting, because we always ask every few years the competitiveness, and there's all these companies, but it seems to be like there seems to be room for everyone, and it seems to be they all seem to be doing pretty well, and the output still seems very high when we look between you, Vinegar Syndrome, obviously AGFA is more on the print side of it.
Well, you do a lot of scans for Vinegar, don't you?
No, they do their own scans, okay. But Joe from Vinegar and I work together quite a lot because he lives out here in LA, and
there's a lot of synchronicity between you and the other labels. That's
indeed, what I'm trying to point out. Particularly Vinegar Syndrome, and you know, we do stuff with AGFA as well. AGFA gave us one of the Al Adamson films because they had the only print that we could find in the world. So
he still has announcements. I'm looking at the list.
What is
he
that?
Still has announcements?
All right. Well, this is not necessarily a horror announcement, but it is a cautionary tale.
It makes me giggy.
And it was actually mentioned in the Severin Cellar, funnily enough, because we did put it there to see if anyone would notice it. But so one of the things that I'm guilty of is from when I was in high school is when I get into an argument with somebody about movies and they're touting some Hollywood nonsense. I talk about how ideologically ugly that Hollywood movie is, and they're bemoaning how horror films are so evil and stuff like that. And so this continues to this day, and more likely than not when I've had a glass of wine or something and I happen to be with some friends having wine, and they were talking, my friend Bobby's wife, Katie, was talking about how one of her favorite films is Overboard. And I said, well, we can get the rights to Overboard, but it is ideologically unsound and there's problems with that movie and blah, 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 blah.
Total Me Too movie.
Let's be clear. What Overboard are we talking about?
Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn.
And the 80s one.
Literally.
She eats food.
When I was a kid, so, literally a favorite movie in my household.
I loved this movie so much.
So
like,
anyway, I said I could get this movie, but you know, and they were like, wouldn't that be funny if Overboard came out on Severin? So as part of, you know, a deal that we were doing on other films with MGM, I said, let's put in an offer for Overboard. Ha, ha, ha. I wake up on Monday morning and my God, they've accepted our offer. So there will be a Severin edition of Overboard.
There will be.
Can we do a Shockwaves horror commentary track where we're looking at it through the veil of if this is a horror film? Because he is, you know, pretending. So
the moral of the story is don't drink and license movies.
Wow. But you know what? To be candid, I don't
know. It'll probably be our most successful film we ever release.
So. I love this movie. Yeah. I know it's so wrong when you look at it now. But
you don't, and you're so right. But when you're young, you did not think of these things back then.
That was always my point when I was having this argument. I'm like, all these 80s, every movie from the 80s has a horrible message behind it.
I rewatched Can't Buy Me Love a couple of months ago, and I was like, wow, this movie is awful, but I love it.
Well, and you'll probably delve into this in the features, but that one in particular, I remember hearing, and maybe this isn't public knowledge yet, but Overboard was a project that Roddy McDowall really wanted to produce, and he does technically have credit, and he's in it.
Yeah,
but I know he was very unhappy with the final result because of other producers.
I went to see it with my sister when it was first released, and we loved it, and we thought it was hilarious.
No, I love the movie too. But I'm saying I think there might.
So at the end of the day, I'm not that pissed off that we're putting. I'm kind of happy, but it was just surprising that
there may be so charming.
There may be Roddy drama behind the scenes.
Oh, so that could be the extra.
I'm giving you that little tidbit right now.
Good to know.
Yep.
Interesting. Well, that was not the title I was expecting.
You were going to guess that.
No, that is not what I was expecting.
I commented on the VHS tape down there, and then suddenly I was like, we thought it was a joke.
Honestly, I didn't believe the VHS tape. I really thought you were just fucking with us and be like, let's see if they buy this.
Do you have
one.
To like package that different, like kind of come up with your own approach?
There are definitely, you know, when you're dealing with a film with big stars in it, you know, there are certain sizes that people's names and heads have to be on the
stuff like their likeness and all that stuff. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
I want to ask about a couple of titles that have come out since the last time you were on. More of a comment. You guys put out The Wax Mask, which is a pretty cool movie, but honestly, the feature that just blew me away, and I don't know why, is I guess it's Beyond Fulci, which is it's the first time I'd heard Dario Argento talk about his relationship with Fulci, and I thought it was so – it made me very emotional hearing what they were like, their relationship towards the end of his life.
Yeah. It was quite the perception is it was very acrimonious, during their careers. But actually, from what I understand, they didn't really speak that much or interact that much at all. But when Dario saw Fulci at some event in Rome, he saw that he was very old and sickly, and he wanted to help him make another movie. Is kind of how the story goes, and that was the birth of Wax Mask. And unfortunately, Fulci died before it actually started. But Fulci actually, when the first script came in, it wasn't particularly violent, and so Dario thought that was a problem. So they actually had to go back and sort of revise it. And then he passed away, and then Stivaletti came in, and of course he made it pretty super violent, and it's definitely it's quite a high end Italian splatter movie from that era, of which there weren't many by then.
It's late 90s. Late 90s, yeah, like
97,
wow.
I think.
Well, I think there's a reason there's a perception of their relationship, because I don't know if it's your giallo documentary or the other. Remember, there's two giallo documentaries. Yeah. One of them has these tape recordings of Fulci, who was just trash-talking. He's just trash-talking Dario.
But he was
so
quite
bad.
Famous for
I know,
that.
But it's so fun to listen to him. He's just like going
It's funny
to
you
town.
Mentioned Fulci, actually. I was going to announce our three Fulci films.
What? Wait, what? You have three Fulci films?
But I'm not going to, because you guys talk so much shit about House by the Cemetery last time.
I am
top two. House is top two for me. It's almost tied with Beyond. I think it's when I was younger, didn't like that one.
Devil's Honey is Shockwaves approved. I'd like to take responsibility for moving a lot of those.
And I'm going to be honest, David. Lizard in the Woman's Skin more times than I can count.
David, you owe us.
Fulci, baby. What's the Fulci story?
Now I've built it up way too much, because they're later Fulci films that have not been in Blu-ray in the US. Not House of Clocks.
Oh,
sweet House of
Clocks. No. It'll be.
Okay, now don't even tell us. I'm curious.
I'll leave it at that, because we haven't even got the scans in at the moment.
But you can tell us it's a Fulci triple.
We've got three Fulci movies from one of them is actually from peak Fulci period, but the other two are from later.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll ask you after mics are off. But there are those titles.
Sorry for that tease, but I wanted to tell you off.
The other two we did.
That was all Turek.
I've never seen the sweet. What is it? Sweet Mother something. That's one of those later Fulcis. It's like there's House Clocks and then there's the sweet.
Was
sweet.
It a TV one?
Yeah, they're TV ones.
House of Clocks is TV.
It's yeah. the one that like Steve Scarlotta keeps saying. It's like Last House on the Left or something, but yeah. like by way of Fulci or something.
But I often do that? Wonder where those will end up at some point, like getting out there eventually, or maybe there sometimes aren't even good prints of some of these. Yeah, I don't know.
The Sweet House of Horrors.
Sweet House of Horrors. Yeah,
yeah.
I've heard some mutterings.
Okay. I watched a little bit of on YouTube once, but it was. Well, this is like painful now because now we have to sit in a room wondering about what Fulci is going to grace.
And he said one is peak Fulci.
Peak Fulci.
You did that.
Peak era Fulci, I believe I said.
Well, let me ask about, here's some blind spots that I think were interesting that you put out. So tell us about the Hemisphere of Horrors box set, because I got this. I haven't even dug in yet, but I don't think I'm familiar with anything that's in here.
David has no idea that he's looking at your screen. Yeah, no. I don't think we put
Wait,
that
what
out.
What is that? Is that ours?
Yeah. Curse of the Vampire.
So we did two box sets. We did the Blood Island box set, yes, followed by the Hemisphere box of horrors. And it's because Hemisphere was the producer of horror movies in the Philippines. And so we did the four Blood Island films in the first box, and then five Hemisphere productions in the second box, two of which were Filipino. Curse of the Vampires and the Blood Drinkers, which anyone who grew up with the book by Dennis Gifford, A Pictorial History of Horror Movies, will know pictures from these Hemisphere movies, and they were very striking.
I still have that book.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I still have it. It's very well worn, but I still have that book. It was probably the book that I looked at the most in my life. But the Blood Drinkers had a very famous picture of this guy basically gnawing at the neck of this girl going, ow. And it was like a very disturbing image, you know, to a child. But one that obviously you came up with all kinds of things in your head of how that movie would be when you finally saw it. And the Blood Drinkers is actually a genuinely good Filipino vampire movie, as is Curse of the Vampires. The third movie is an Al Adamson movie, Brain of Blood, which was supposed to be a follow-up to those Blood Island movies because they couldn't get Eddie Romero and Gerardo de Leon to make another movie quick enough. So Al Adamson and Sam Sherman basically said, well, we can do it for half the price in half the time. And they did that one. And then there was two films that were released by Hemisphere because they were a releasing company here in the US, which was The Torture Chamber of Dr. Sadism and The Black Cat. And The Black Cat is another one that if you had that...
Is that from 66? Yeah. The black and white one?
Yeah. That Pictorial History of Horror Movies has a picture in it with this blonde lady with an axe in her head and blood dripping out of her mouth. And I just remember thinking, that is got to be
I watched
amazing
that this
movie.
Weekend, and it's I watched the Something Weird DV minus so R. That's in there. And it's, you put that one
yeah,
up.
So that's in that
Oh,
box.
I wish I'd known that. It's a great little film.
Yeah.
It's regional horror, but doing the Edgar Allan Poe story, but
it's
with like
a Texan
mod.
Movie. And it's got all this mod stuff for the era and things like
but
that.
But it's actually
very
pretty
cool
creepy,
movie.
And the guy's really losing his mind. And it's actually a couple really striking horror beats to it, like an axe to the head kind of moment where I was like, oh, you know, it kind of surprised me.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's funny. That's funny. Tell me, I didn't know there was a better release of it. So.
Yeah, well, it's still from the same print, I believe, that made that. It's a release print, so it's still a damaged print, but it is a 4K scan.
Okay, cool.
I mean, again, it's just like with our collective knowledge, we feel like we've seen everything. No, and then never. You will put out a box set or announce something that it's like, what is this?
Yeah. You just recently did the Penelope Spheres movie, The Boys Next Door.
Absolutely. Great. I love
movie. I have not seen this one. Oh, wow. I was excited
movie.
To watch this.
Really?
Yeah. The movie's incredible.
Oh, cool. It's Charlie Sheen's like one of his
Caulfield.
First films, right?
Cool.
I kind of call it like teenage Henry Porter of serial killer.
Yeah. Well, it's more gnarly. Kind of, it's got kind of a Badlands feel about it. It's like a road movie. It's they basically are two disaffected youths who go to Los Angeles looking for something away from, you know, their high school where they're not getting along with anyone, and then they get there and then there's this repressed relationship between them, and one of them's incredibly violent, and it's an incredibly violent movie. I remember seeing a clip of it on our film review program. The English equivalent of Siskel and Ebert was with Barry Norman, called Film 84 at the time. It changed its name every year. And just seeing the clip where Maxwell Caulfield throws a Coke bottle in the air when they're at Venice Beach and it hits an old lady in the head and blood starts pouring out of her head. And then this woman in a bikini jumps on the front of their car and they're driving away with her. Oh, my God. It was absolutely shocking. And Barry Norman was like, this movie is way too violent to be appreciated or to make any point. And I was like, I have to see that movie.
Yep. Wow.
And it totally lived up to it. I mean, Penelope Spheres, badass filmmaker.
And is that one in the cave?
Yes, it is.
Is there a way to put out Dudes as well?
Dudes is already out. I noticed you mentioned that last time, but yeah. Actually Shout Factory put that
really?
Out.
Really? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's one I'd been waiting for a while.
It took a while because the same company produced Fright Night 2 and some other films that have kind of fallen off the radar.
One of the greatest sequels in the history of movies.
Yes.
Well, to some of this room.
I believe Penelope and Shout Factory were able to figure out Dudes somehow, but it is out on
Blu-ray
now.
Excellent. Okay. I'm getting a copy of that. I thought that was trapped on VHS. Yeah.
I know what I'm going to go back to the cave for now. I haven't even heard of that one. I don't know how.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's totally not.
I didn't know what it was either. Yeah. But we somehow ended up with two copies of it in our trivia prizing, and it was one of these where I was like getting ready to give it out, and then I held it up and was like, "I want to see this.
This looks great."
Well, way back in my Tower Records days, we used to have the cult section, and it was one of those cult favorites. Mm-hmm.
It was advertised like it was a Brat Pack movie because it was that era when, you know, Charlie Sheen had been in Ferris Bueller's Day Off or was about to be in it or something like that. So they just looked like teenagers on the front of the
And then you're watching
thing,
like,
it's like, Jesus Christ, this thing's violent.
That was
even Penelope's Ferris is a little regretful of how violent the movie is now. She's not ashamed of it or anything. She's on the disc, but she's like, I'm not sure I would make that movie now.
Well, Suburbia is pretty brutal.
Yeah, we watched it right after Suburbia.
There were moments of that are so bleak. Yeah.
There was another Penelope Spheeres movie that we mentioned last week, Summer Camp Nightmare.
Yeah, I've never seen that one.
That's a good. You should try.
It's violent too.
Nobody's got the blue of that yet. Yeah. I don't even think it came out on DVD. It's one of those VHS movies.
VHS only.
But it's probably not as good as I remember. But maybe it is.
It feels a little exploitive now, just because it is. It's Lord of the Flies at a summer camp, where the campers don't like the way they're being treated by the counselors, so they mutiny and take over the camp. And then it really just turns into Lord of the Flies. So there's
Chuck
parts
Connors?
Of it,
mm-hmm. isn't it right?
Yep. There's parts of it that feel pretty exploited now. It's definitely got some rape revenge-y elements to it. But that said, it's definitely kind of a hidden gem. Much I would say probably in the same vein of The Boys Next Door, where it is kind of hyper violent, but there's a beauty in that.
We always do this every time somebody's on. But what are some titles that we want to move some titles? What are some titles that you're very proud of that maybe not a lot of people have discovered yet?
That's a good question.
Or that you have sitting on your shelf because they're not getting to it. You printed too many.
You want to sell more Next of Kin? I mean, Elric's a big guy.
Yeah, I am a big guy. I think Next of Kin is
so gorgeous.
I mean, I have to say the wax mask didn't sell as well as we expected. But also, I'm looking over. You've got my screen on there, so I need to see that.
Actually, Masked Mutilator is a really bizarre movie.
Yeah, that's a bizarre movie. That's an Intervision, you know.
I have this one sitting on my desk. What's Paganini Horror? It's
Paganini
Italian,
Horror
right?
is a Luigi Cozzi movie, the guy who made...
Alien ripoff, right?
Yeah, Contamination.
Yes.
How dare you call it?
It's so funny because
how else could it be described?
It has really good effects. Yeah. Contamination has
Paganini
really
Horror.
It's pretty slow.
Kind of has to be seen to be believed. It's co-written by Daria Nicolodi, who we know from various Argento
Shock.
Films. She's in it as well, and she's in Shock as well. And I think she wrote it as to be like a third mother film. It's not, but it's that kind of era after the peak era of Italian horror. So it's late 80s and Luigi Cozzi was still, you know, making movies fairly regularly. In fact, he's still making movies, but it's a very bizarre slasher movie based around a rock band who do a song that's extremely reminiscent of a Bon Jovi song. And I'm surprised they did not get shut down because of that. Maybe they did. Maybe that's why it never came out in the US. But that rock band would go to a haunted house to make a rock video, and mayhem ensues.
And Donald Pleasence is in it.
Oh, cool.
Yes, he is. It's one of Donald Pleasence's last films. That's right. That's right. I would say The Uncanny sold less than I would have hoped, because I'm a big fan of The Uncanny. But again, it's one that I saw when I was very young. Yeah. It's one of the last Amicus anthologies. It's actually not Amicus. It's after Amicus split up, but Milton Subotsky made it with Peter Cushing, and it's three tales about nasty cats.
Yeah. And I saw Peter Cushing cover. Right. I haven't seen this one yet either. Well, so that's one that I know I'm going to enjoy.
Did
things like Threads move? And
oh, Threads did very well. Yeah. Threads, strangely enough, Threads did particularly well on DVD. More, not more so than Blu-ray, but it did more so than most releases do these days, which would lead you to believe maybe it was an older demographic that was getting it, or people who are sheltered in their house and haven't gone out and gotten a Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
They only have a DVD, as in, you know, they're afraid of the war or something. But anyway, Threads did very well for us. It was surprisingly popular.
Controversial, but I like Killer Crocodile better than Crawl, just saying.
I have to agree. But I would say that
they're both great.
I haven't seen Killer Crocodile.
One of it's them is
Killer Crocodile is great fun, and they made two of them in very close proximity.
Yes.
And you can still get the two pack, which has both of them in.
And it's a real rubber alligator.
So yes, it is. And Ginetto De Rossi, the guy who did the effects on Zombie and the Beyond, is the guy who created the crocodile and co-directed Killer Crocodile 2.
Obviously, there's titles out there that you would love to release because that's what probably keeps you going. Is there anything out there that is just still trapped on VHS that you've always been wanting to get out that you can even talk about? Or are they like, I mean, for us,
whale.
The one I, we were, because this comes up because last week we were doing a show at the, of VHS titles, a lot of it. And I bring up, I bring up The Black Room a lot, that Norman Thaddeus.
Yes.
And that's, I think there's quite a few people who like the idea of that. I don't know if that could ever come out. What's the.
Yeah, no, there's a very specific hold up. Okay, on that one.
So often legal.
I know
issues,
one
right?
label who is not us that is working
hard
on it. But still, for me, it's Blood for Dracula and Flesh for Frankenstein, which have been on DVD, but they are in need of a
series. And the Warhol the Warhol company is pretty hard to make deals with, right?
It's not the Warhol company.
Oh, it's not those.
It's Paul Morrissey himself.
Yes.
Which is weird because I actually finally tracked down those Australian discs,
which aren't really they're up-res. Standard Def Masters.
Wow.
Yeah. I haven't actually seen them myself, but that's what I understand they are.
Okay.
Because who knows where the actual elements are, but Paul Morrissey's not letting us at them.
Lovely guy.
And we probably wouldn't get it anyway if they were ever actually made available. I'm sure somebody else would sneak to them. But we have started making the extras just in case Blood for Dracula was shot in the same location as Burial Ground. So I got Stefania Cassini to come down to the house and walk us through the house where all the stuff happened.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I won't grill you too hard on extra ones because I am always curious what are the ones, because I think that's part of like the keeping going is like one day we're gonna find a way to get that title out, and sometimes it works, sometimes somebody else grabs it. But
yeah, no, I mean there's still a lot of stuff out there that's either really in need of an upgrade or hasn't been out at all on Blu-ray, and we seem to have no shortage of them coming up.
Yeah, exciting. Well, I'm excited for you with this Al Adamson, not just the box, I think the film itself. I think the film deserves to get seen by a lot of people. I think a lot of people fall in love with these types of filmmakers because they're like, it feels like impossible dreamers.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds you why you do this stuff. And it seems to be, he seems very beloved by the people who worked with him. And that's something I didn't know about him, which I really enjoyed. So I hope people like Rob discovering without knowing the film, that's exciting because it means that there's a chance for people who know nothing about this to stumble upon it. So
yeah, I mean, what a great way to get a sample of his work was through the docs.
So. Yeah, it was a pleasure to make the documentary, and I'm glad it's now out because it's been a lot of work, and but it's it has been a pleasure to do because meeting all these people and hearing their stories and their recollections is. Never gets old, but
most of all, it brought you to us. It brought you to this very moment.
This very moment, indeed. I never would have met you.
I mean, otherwise. How would you have known? How could you have stumbled into this? But no, yeah. I mean, look, just keep up the great work. We appreciate it. We love seeing this. This stuff gets such beautiful releases. Sometimes it's bonkers when you see something that looks like you've only ever seen VHS or YouTube quality, and then you see it in these HD masters in your brain. It's like a totally different film.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, so you can watch Blood and Flesh right now digitally, and you've got multiple versions of it, the box set, different like bundles and packs available on severn-films.com. Thank you for revealing quite a lot of cool,
we
crazy
got some
titles.
Good titles.
Which I definitely didn't expect any of those.
Overboard.
Overboard, Cruel Jaws.
All about the Overboard.
What were the Fulci ones again?
I forgot.
Nice try, Alric.
Well done.
Another scan of Seth.
Fulci's overboard would be interesting.
Hey, you know? There we go.
It's like Fulci and Cat in the Brain and a woman, and he's trying to trick
her. Isn't that Devil's Honey?
Oh, that's yes, like, you're right. Oh, wait, we've just found the ultimate double feature. Devil's Honey overboard double.
Wow.
So what is the upcoming event you were talking about where you screen some of the movies?
Yeah, the Severin Super Shock Pop-Up Film Festival will be happening on March 28th in Hollywood at the Montalban Theater in Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
And tickets will be going on sale, I believe, next week. And like I say, it's three features that we have not officially announced yet. And also we'll be showing a couple of shorts, which will tease two more features and several trailers for films we haven't announced. And also there'll be gift bags and stuff like that. And it will be a fabulous do. Cool. It'll start at 4 and end at midnight.
Wow.
That sounds fantastic.
Right, let's start planning now.
Yes. Yeah, can we come? Absolutely. We want to come. All
right, cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. David Gregory, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we will see you guys next week.
And you can go see us in their vault.
In their
vault.
There's
a video of us.
Should be up by now.
I assume it's on the YouTube. Search the show, and that's a lot of tomfoolery. All right.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Danier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pacetta, and Rob Galuzzo.